from the slowly warming studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another hopeful hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. We're having a late freeze. Should I throw blankets over my plants to protect them? And should I prune big plants to protect them from potential ice storms? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll answer those frequently asked questions. Plus, a heap and helping of your fabulous fun call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and eloquently elaborate elucidations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like your plants thanking you for staying inside.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Kleenex-strewn studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another allergenic hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we celebrate the upcoming season of sneezing by revealing which American cities have been graded the worst for pollen allergies. The story by reporter Kasia Patel for The Washington Post carries this headline: where does your city rank on the list of U.S. allergy capitals? Now, unlike other news rats that keep the good stuff until the end, I will immediately reveal that residents of Wichita have many great, wonderful things to enjoy, including legendary sunflower farms and a great Frank Lloyd Wright house. Pollen levels? Not so great. The home of Dorothy was named the nation's number one worst for pollen problems. The bad news, courtesy of a report recently released by the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America, recounts where people allergic to pollen had it the worst last year. Now, about a quarter of U.S. adults suffer from seasonal allergy, notes the Post article, many experiencing itchy and watery eyes, a scratchy throat, and an ever-running nose. The cause, pollen exposure, is now lasting longer throughout the season and intensifying as warmer temperatures occur over much of the year. And for some areas, the changes have been dramatic. The top cities for allergy sufferers were in the Midwest and Southeast, regions expected to see a lot more pollen as the climate warms. For the third year in a row, Wichita, Kansas was the most challenging place to live. New Orleans ranked the second most challenging, jumping up 30 points from last year due to higher levels of weed pollen fueled by record warmth and moisture. The story continues. In his nearly 50-year career, immunologist Maurice Strickland has practiced in several states and big cities, but he's never seen a place as bad as Wichita. The people here have a lot of allergies, more than any other place I ever lived or practiced in, he said. Okay, now some quote-unquote good news that you may or may not agree with. Some of the least problematic places are in the Northeast, a result of low pollen, probably from droughts, and above-average access to medical help. Boston, which was ranked the least challenging allergy city, experienced relatively low tree, grass, and weed pollen levels, and it has a high number of allergists. Now, excuse me? The susceptible person who inhales a snootful of ragweed in the fall does not care how far it is to the nearest allergist. They just know that they're blowing through the tissues and eye drops at a rapid rate. I thought I had uncovered a scandal. All those allergists were in these regions because more people had allergies there. But the raw data supports the cause as massive increases in pollen levels as the earth warms. Research has shown that pollen season now starts 20 days earlier than it did 30 years ago. Pollen counts have increased by 21% over the same period, with the greatest increases in the Midwest and Texas. We'll post a link to the complete article at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page when this show drops. In the meantime, can I get a tissue?
You've already discovered that this NPR station is an excellent source of news and entertainment, but did you know that this station is a nonprofit? Public radio is for the public, available to all free of charge. That is possible thanks to people just like you who give what they can to support open access to information. So thank you for listening and for making all of this possible.
Call 610-758-8810 or give online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, two gardeners and what they did to protect their garlic over sudden freezes. After another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Robert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey there. Thank you very much for bringing me on. I've been a long-time listener and enjoyed so much your tips on organic gardening over the years.
Yes, you have communicated with me via email over the years on, let's call it, scientific topics and things like that, right?
Absolutely. Botany's important.
Now, are you a professional?
Not at all. I'm retired, but I've spent a lot of time growing trees from seed over the last 20 years because of a neighbor I met by chance who was a horticultural interpretist at the University Arboretum. And so I've been trying to pay attention to how things actually work.
Oh, okay. And where are you located?
I'm located in Guelph, Ontario, northernmost range of the Carolinian Forest.
Up in the 51st state, yes.
So some people like to say.
Yeah. Now, you're here to help me out. A couple of shows ago, somebody asked me about their pawpaw trees they had, but they weren't getting pawpaws. And I knew from doing interviews and research, but not recently, that you need two different varieties of pawpaws to get fruit. And somehow I mangled that, and I got a lot of responses correcting me. However, every correction contradicted the other corrections. But you seemed to have a better handle on it than most. Now, to set the stage, the pawpaw is one of the two Native American fruits, along with persimmons, produces huge custard-like fruits filled with seeds, has very unique growing habits. It's certainly not pollinated by bees. It's pollinated by flies and or beetles.
Yeah, fly beetles or ants will pollinate them.
Because it stinks.
Yeah, it's a flower that evolved on the planet before bees showed up, and so they have to smell like rotting fruit in order to get a pollinator in there, and that pawpaws do it.
Okay. Now, Where does the other tree come from that eventually this patch becomes productive?
Yeah, that's a good question. In terms of evolution, that's really requiring animals to do the scattering of various types of genetic strains in the same region to get that pollination take place. But what I heard from your listener, it sounded like she had a single genetic variant that produced a very large colony where everything would have been the same, and but would have tried to do some self-pollination, but they all would have been aborted because the pawpaw flowers, well, they're perfect flowers. The male and female parts don't ripen at the same time, so the fruit will often be misshapen or aborted or small.
So now you have kind of answered my question, because the fruits are enormous. They are known to drop to the ground when ripe, and I would think any number of creatures would love to get in there. They'd swallow the seeds, deposit the seeds elsewhere, but then wouldn't that seed still grow the same pawpaw?
It will, but if you've got a number of animals that are hitting a bunch of different pawpaw trees in a region and are traveling around, then you're going to get some genetic diversity eventually. And when you think of, you know, like the way that seeds work on planet Earth, I mean, a tree will produce bazillions of seeds, and only a very tiny percentage of them are ultimately going to germinate. Most are going to be eaten. So it's kind of nature plays the odds the best it can.
So somebody's got a grove of pawpaws. What can they do to make sure? Would you call it a different cultivar or different variety?
I think it doesn't have to be a different cultivar per se, so long as it's just a different plant itself, because that different plant will have male and female flowers that will ripen at a different time than that colony will, odds are, and you'll get a much better strength of pollination. So they just need to introduce a new tree into there. What's interesting in America is there's been so much experimentation with pawpaw trees and growing different strains that will fruit at different times, that will be more shelf stable. That's where you might run into trouble, because you do want to have a flower that is going to be flowering at relatively the same time as your colony is flowering in order to get that cross-pollination. But you just need it to be genetically different. That's all.
And up until at least recently, these trees, these fruits were not well studied because they had incredibly limited commercial possibilities. This seems to like be a fruit that, you know, you got like 3 days of a window to really experience that tropical custard flavor.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it was so popular that even George Washington preferred his pawpaws chilled as a dessert. And Thomas Jefferson, who you discussed a little while ago as well, was growing them out in Monticello. So they are a much beloved fruit. The other thing that's unique about them is they don't have a lot of insects or diseases that affect them. So that's why there is a lot of kind of research that's being done. I think specifically by Kent State, they're doing a lot of research on developing different strains to see if they can get, you know, some better shelf stability out of it, because it does have potential to be a really great fruit, so long as you eat it when it's ripe. Because if you eat it when it's not ripe, the stomach pains that you will get will be outstanding.
I knew that the ripeness was a short window, but I didn't realize an unripe pawpaw would make you sick.
Yeah, it could cause some severe stomach distress, and the seeds are completely toxic and should not be consumed at all.
Is this the plant's way of making sure that nothing eats the fruit before the seeds are viable?
That sounds pretty accurate. And the other thing I know about them is that deer also are fairly repulsed by pawpaws. I mean, they might eat the tips of young pawpaws, but for the most part, the chemicals in the leaves keep deer away from it. So because it's such an old plant, it's a tree that was around on planet Earth like between 35 to 53 million years ago, I think it's evolved a lot of great defenses over time.
Now, again, when pawpaws are difficult, if not impossible, to plant other than by seed, propagation tends not to be successful. They have a long tap root that's miserable to try to get to adapt being in the ground. I mean, how do you buy a pawpaw?
Yeah, that's it's a good challenge that you bring up. I've got my original pawpaws from the University Arboretum, and I was just there visiting a while ago where they were explaining fresh pawpaw seeds, warm stratification for 60 days, and then popped in the ground into a cool environment, and then it goes over that whole year, and then you see what you get the next year. And what I did is I just put my seeds in a pot and left them outside. And about 2 years later, I had about 20 pawpaws that showed up in a pot, and I just transplanted a whole bunch of them into individual pots. They are very sensitive. The roots are very sensitive and finicky about being transplanted, so I just put them into really big pots, crossing my fingers, hope the best that some of them survive, and we'll see how it goes. But if you do get it from like a reputable source, there are different plant centers now, native plant centers that will sell pawpaws, and which is, I think, better to try to get a tree if you can that's a little bit more mature, because the average wait time is about 5 to 7 years for a pawpaw tree to flower from seed. So that's a long time to wait to get some fruit happening in your yard.
So let's say you do buy a tree or a bunch of trees. Are you getting it bare root? How do you protect that taproot that doesn't like to be transferred?
Yeah. Well, good pawpaw growers will have very deep pots. They have those big, long deep pots for the taproot to go through there. I was told by the arboretum you can, with young pawpaw seedlings, prune their roots a little bit. They won't cry too much over that. But you are really looking for a reputable grower. So if you can find, you know, the arboretum that does a plant sale, which I have in my area, or you've got native plant environments, which I think are increasing more and more. And certainly in America, there's a lot more strains that are happening now and developed. So I'm sure there has to be, if you look hard enough, you will find plant centers that will sell you either a pawpaw that's bare root or will be in the pot and ready to go.
So a tall pot, cut the bottom out, drop it in the ground, and let the taproot just continue to grow?
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. As soon as I got my two young pawpaws that I put in from the arboretum, after about 3 or 4 years, it started to mate with my single one that had produced no fruit at all. And now I've got pretty young trees, but I've got an abundance of fruit every year.
Oh, good for you. How long did it take you to achieve fruit?
I think for me it was about 5 years. From the time that I actually purchased these plants, and the plants were about maybe 2 feet tall, maybe a foot and a half tall. They were pretty young. They might have only been a year or two old.
So, again, if you have a clutch of trees that's not doing anything, how to ensure that you're going to get another, a different one?
Again, so long, because odds are it's not going to have anything genetically to do with the same tree that you've got there at all. But all it just needs is to be a different tree. And that will have its timings be a little bit different in terms of when the flowers are going to be ripening. That's the only thing that matters. It's not like with some fruit trees where you need, you know, two different cultivars in order to have that strength of diversity. This is really about, it can be the exact same Asimina triloba, like the original plant, Asimina triloba, just so long as it's a different one. And it's not, you know, one from your colony, you're good to go.
Okay. Well, I think that confuses us even further. People love this topic, man. I don't have to tell you.
Yeah, it's a hot one.
All right, Robert. Well, thank you for coming to my rescue. And
no,
keep on listening and helping me out when you can.
No problem. Thanks, Mike. You have a
good
day.
All right. Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and deliver some breaking news. I'll be back on stage to talk about tomatoes and turf and answer your garden questions live at 1 o'clock on Saturday, May 10th at the Nurture Nature Center in Easton, which is just across the street from their historic State Theater. The event is free, but please bring a food bank donation if you can. Don't go making plans to attend just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss growing garlic and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in beautiful downtown Bethlehem. Well, okay, we're not downtown, but we're in beautiful Bethlehem, okay? What are you, a cop? We are happy to have you back for this segment, which is going to be nothing but your fabulous phone calls to 610-694-8100. Extension number 3. Be patient. Mira, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I've been listening for a very long time, so I'm really excited to talk to you.
Well, recently you could have been watching and listening and, you know, Lord knows what else. But thank you, and thank you for being had. Where are you?
I'm in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay. Very good. Nice to hear from that part of the country. What can we do you for?
Yeah, so I have had this, I have a hedgerow of hollies. I'm pretty sure they're the Blue Princess variety, and they've been struggling for several years. Recently, I had an arborist come by to check them out, and he said that they are struggling with canker and that all of them need to come out and that he had suggested some replacement ideas. The hollies are over 30 years old, and I can describe to you what's going on with them, like what they look like specifically. So I guess I was kind of curious, do they all need to come out? Is it something that's treatable? If they do come out, how easily is canker transmissible to any plants that I replace them with? So that's kind of the
Those are all good questions. So they've been in the ground 30 years, but you did email us some pictures, and they didn't look like 30-year-old plants.
It's possible they're not. I've only been in this house for 6 years or so. There were some hollies on the original plans of the house, so I'm assuming that they're the same ones, but it's possible that they've been replaced along the way.
Okay. Because, and no offense, but they look like the dog's breakfast.
They are, my neighbors keep asking me what my plan is, so I got to do something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, I was shocked when I looked at the pictures. I was going, are you sure these are hollies? You know.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely sure they look like hollies. They produce really, and they're still producing berries. I use more holly tone fertilizer over the last couple of years, and that same arborist was doing injection fertilizer treatments, and they actually have bounced back substantially, but maybe not well enough.
Okay. Now, you have to realize whenever you call someone in to look at plants on your property, that's a potential sale of something to them.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So canker, which we'll get into in a minute, there's no reason to fertilize, and there's no need for fertilizer injections. When did nature ever walk around the forest with a big syringe going, here you go, this won't hurt? Yeah, no, canker, if anything, overfeeding would not cause canker, but it would encourage it. Canker really refers to the symptoms, the split bark, the black blotchy areas that occur, the deformed branches. You know, and is that what you're seeing?
So I do have large sections of some of the holly plants that are browned out. Some of the leaves also have black spots on them. That's probably the first symptom that I started to notice over 5 years ago, was the black spots on the leaves. When I was looking at the bark, I couldn't see areas that were, I couldn't really differentiate the disease. I didn't really see areas
when
that
you,
were cracked.
When you look at the plants, we realize they're not pleasant looking, but is there anything deformed about their basic structure, their trunk, their branches?
Doesn't seem like it to me.
Okay, you don't have canker.
Okay, other than the big parts that are browned out.
No, I didn't say browned out, deformed.
Okay, but deformed. No, it doesn't look deformed. There's a couple of sections that'll have kind of like, it looks like moss growing on it, but that's about it.
Yeah, none of that is canker. Now, the moss leads me to believe that they don't get enough sun.
Okay. They're on the, what side is that? That's the west side of the house.
Right.
So it does feel like they do get some sun, but yeah, it is possible that it's not enough.
Okay. But you didn't install them. You bought the house and was told that there was a 30-year-old planting, but you suspect that they planted them anew right before you moved in.
Oh, I actually, they didn't give me any information. I kind of just assumed that they were about the age of the house, but I really don't know how old they are.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. And what's at their base? Are they growing out of grass? Are there weeds around them? Are they touching?
They're growing out of a garden bed. There's really nothing, maybe like some like clover growing, some weeds, but not a significant amount. It's pretty bare underneath.
Okay, so they're not surrounded by grass, long, tall, grassy weeds or anything like that.
Correct.
Okay. And now is the time. Now, in the pictures, it appears that at least one of them had turned completely brown.
Yes.
How many brownies do we have?
We have, I believe there were about 20 in the front yard, and 4 are decidedly dead, and maybe 3 other ones are brown and maybe dead, kind of hard to say. Although I would say, actually, one of the ones that seems, I was going to say, was fairly dead, I cut back some of the brown sections last year, and there is some new growth growing from the base of the hollies.
The good news here, which I learned from the caretaker of a local arboretum many years ago, maybe it was Tyler Arboretum, but they specialized in hollies. And I have a blue holly that was given to me to, quote, test years ago, which is like turning Superman over to Lex Luthor for a checkup. And it grew awkwardly. It developed a bad shape. There was a side branch that came out that overtook the look of the plant. And I was talking with him about it. And he said, you are so lucky. Hollies can be cut back almost to the ground, and they will regrow. They're very hardy plants. And with any luck, yours will regrow straight. But you're also going to pay attention now and prune off any branches going in directions you don't like early on. So you should have been taking out any brown areas as soon as they appeared.
Okay.
Now, any hollies that are completely brown, I would urge you to cut them back, cut off all of the branches, leave as much of the stump as you can. And the other ones, prune pretty strongly. Prune them for shape. Prune them to get rid of any brown areas, anything that doesn't look good. Hollies are something that, unlike other plants, you can go out and you can get pruning happy. Just don't cut off any healthy parts. And then when you're done, take a look at what you've got. Maybe you don't want to wait for those 4 to regrow. Mine regrew faster than I thought it would. But if everything is looking good, and you should see signs of new sprouts even this year if you do this, By the way, use a bow saw. Use a real garden implement. Don't use a wood cutting saw, or you may prove that they're not invulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, you can always fake it. You can get a nice big planter, or, you know, build a garden box of some kind to hide the bad ones. Nobody's going to know. It'll look like you did it deliberately. You can put out statues of the little boy. But get rid of the bad parts. And, okay. You know, cut down. If it looks dead, let's see. Let's get rid of the overgrowth, over the top of the stump growth. Give them, I'd say, another month to show you what's really dead and what isn't. But all this time period, especially where you are with when summer isn't going to come on fast and strong, you got plenty of time to do this. But you don't have canker, and you should thank your lucky stars.
Yeah, thank you so much.
By the way, I heard you say you're using Holytone. Are you using it excessively? How are you applying it?
Maybe, honestly, I intend to do it twice a year, but it ends up being once a year, and it's around the drip line of the plant. And I apply whatever the directions on the bag say.
Okay. What time of year have you chosen to do the feeding?
It's probably, I buy the bags in the fall with best intentions, or in the spring with best intentions, and don't put it in until the fall. So.
Okay, you're hurting the plants.
Okay.
The plants are trying to go dormant, and you're slapping them awake. Worst time to feed a plant is when it's trying to go sleepies.
Okay.
So get off your couch. Wasn't that nice? And get your Holytone. Apply it lightly. Do what you're saying. And then do you have access to any compost?
I think my town has compost that I can acquire from them.
Okay, make sure it smells right, looks right, and feels right, you know.
Okay.
But after you apply your Holytone, put an inch of compost around on top of the Holytone, because all granular fertilizers need to be covered with some sort of soil to activate them. But the black spots on the bottoms of your leaves show me that they are picking up a disease. And compost around the base of the plant is the world's best disease preventer.
Okay. So if I do, so pruning for shape, how much of the plant is safe to prune for shape?
Well, for shape, especially, you know, everything you have is in intensive care right now. So I'm going to repeat, don't cut off anything healthy. Just cut off the bad parts. Feel free to prune away any lower branches that do get spots on them. But otherwise, just the damaged stuff, minor pruning for shape, because we want to see what the healthy part of the plant looks like when it all leafs out, like by June or July, then you'll really see where you stand.
Okay, that's good to know.
You know, water them during dry times if you have a drought.
Okay, and then the pruning the disease branches, that includes the ones that have black spots on them.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, anything that doesn't look right. And you can be fearless because it's going to regrow. You may just have to do a little subtle garden hiding behind the curtain trick until they look complete again. But I tell you, just by getting rid of the bad stuff, making sure nothing tall a weedy is growing around them, it's going to make a huge difference. And the more compost you put around that entire area, the better the area will look, and it'll prevent disease. 1 or 2 inches of compost is a great all-purpose feeding, but it also looks and prevents weeds just as well as those lousy wood chips. So it's really, that's the medicine we're needing here. And don't let the guy with the needle back.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds good. And then, sorry, one last question. So the compost, if I'm not able to get it through my town and I purchase it, is it like a mushroom compost? Or I guess, what do you recommend?
Go to the archive of our previous answers, because we just did that. And it should be up near the top. Go to the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. There's a link to the question of the week. Hit that, and you'll soon see what kind of soil should I use. What's the difference between composts? I think there's one specifically on mushroom compost and the differences.
Okay. Great.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much for your help. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, good luck, and let us know how it works.
Okay, certainly. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that right now is the time for you to show your financial support for You Bet Your Garden, our presenting station, WDIY in Bethlehem, and public broadcasting in her hour of greatest need, by becoming a member of WDIY. Just go to WDIY.org and click the Donate Now button at the top of the page. But don't be going and doing that donation just yet, because we'll be right back with Plants, Trust, and Patience, and more of your patient phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Hey, anybody on our crew know what we have planned for next week's show? I'm Mike McGrath, and the crew all ran out of the room, so we got no idea what you'll hear. Join us anyway for the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, and be surprised as the rest of us. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, the tale of two gardeners and what they did to protect their garlic over sudden freezes during the winter. Also, a plea that you follow the advice that the right person did. You'll figure out what I'm saying after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Mac, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Mac. Glad to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm great, sir. And yourself?
I'm just ducky, thanks for asking. Where are you, Mac?
Memphis, Tennessee.
All right. What a pleasure. What can we do you for?
My tomatoes and my fruit trees, the tomatoes, before it began to ripe, it started turning dark at the bottom.
Right.
And then it just get darker. And on the fruit trees, the same thing. It started turning dark. And then it turns to a fungus.
Huh. What kind of fruit trees?
It's a pear tree, peach tree, and a plum tree.
Okay, let's deal with the tomatoes first. How do you grow your tomatoes? How do you support them?
I grow them sometime in a pot, but most of the time just in the soil. And just the natural soil. I don't put any compost or anything around it, just the natural soil with triple 13 fertilizer.
Oh, that's it. Ding, ding, ding. That's death to plants.
Is that right?
Yeah. The problem is there's no plant in the world that wants equal numbers of each of those nutrients. And especially for growing tomatoes, you don't need a high first number, which is nitrogen. You could use a big second number, potassium. And then the third number is like an all-around just plant nutrient. It doesn't have any specialties. But nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, you'd be looking for like a 3-6-4 or something in that ratio. Nitrogen, it's very easy to over-nitrogen a plant, but the phosphorus makes the plant stronger, improves flowering and fertility, and the potash just is just good for the plant in general. I think you're stunting the growth of your tomatoes in the pots.
Okay.
If you're going to continue in the pots, and there's no reason not to, you would stick to what are called dwarf varieties. You know, your big heirlooms and stuff, they need to be in the ground. Now, you know not to plant tomatoes in the same spot year after year.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So as you rotate them, what I want you to do is dig a deeper hole than you're used to digging and pull off the bottom leaves of the plant. Tomato plants don't need those leaves, but every part of the root you bury underground will grow auxiliary roots that will make the plant much healthier. And then I generally agree with don't put anything special in the planting hole, but in your case, this is a sign of calcium deficiency.
Okay.
The rotting out of the bottom of the tomatoes. Very common. So, you know, what I do is I save up my eggshells during the year and I put the crushed shells of a dozen eggs into each planting hole.
Okay. But
you want to get that calcium down in the hole where the roots can get at it. Then you fill back the hole with the soil you dug up. Instead of the chemical fertilizer you're using, now get that bag of tomato fertilizer, natural tomato fertilizer, and rough it into the soil around your plants, not touching them, going out about 6 inches, and then cover that with more soil. No matter what type it is, granulated fertilizers need to be covered with soil or compost to become active. Now, how are we caring for these fruit trees? Are we doing anything to them?
No, we hadn't done anything, and I don't know if they bloomed already. And I don't know if it's too late to put something in the ground or spray them with something. I don't know.
So what I want you to do, starting with the peach, I want you to get a pair of pruners and prune away a good third of the branches. Branches that are interfering with airflow to the center of the plant, any branches that look damaged. And then when the fruit appears, peaches must be thinned. When you got fruit out there that's the size of, say, a marble, you want to remove 1/3 to 1/2 of those marbles, and that gives the other peaches room to grow and prevents them getting crowded and picking up fungal diseases.
Okay.
The pear tree, just give a light pruning to get rid of any cross branches or branches that showed signs of disease. Same with the plum. And as the season progresses, if you see a bad piece of fruit, get it out of there.
Okay.
And throw it in the trash so that it doesn't spread.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You should do better.
All right. I appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
Our pleasure, Mac. Thank you. As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are giving the musical title. Careful with that garlic, Eugene, and hey, gardener, leave those plants alone. Valerie in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada writes, I always plant garlic on October 15th, and this year the little green sprouts came up in December. The weather stayed warm for a while, but then turned cold, and the little sprouts got covered with lots of snow. Then a warm early spring melted that snow, and the sprouts were looking good. Then, of course, it got really cold, between minus 10 and minus 17 Celsius every night. That's single-digit temperatures for you in Fahrenheit land. I was getting ready to put blankets over the sprouts, but then I read one of your articles that assured me I didn't need to. Thank you. On the other hand, Gene in Cherry Hill, New Jersey writes, how will I know when my garlic is ready to dig up if the sprouts died over winter? They were about 6 inches tall when the forecast said temperatures would drop down into the 20s. I had bagged up a lot of fall leaves and basically just buried the garlic sprouts under a pile of heavy, wet leaves. When the weather warmed up, I removed the leaves and there were no sprouts. It's already April and still no signs of sprouts. I have a feeling I might have snuffed them. P.S. To make things worse, the garlic was a Florida variety. Well, let's begin with the mysterious reference to Florida garlic, a term I had never heard before, but the all-knowing Google revealed that the annual South Florida Garlic Festival was held back in February. Come on, what's their slogan? Come for the beaches, stay for the cloves? Anyway, it turns out that there are quite a few sites devoted to Florida garlic growing, and as expected, all suggest growing soft-necked varieties, aka California garlic, white garlic, which do well with less of a chill over winter, and they do store well after harvest. But true garlic lovers, who appreciate the wild wrapper colors and superior flavor of hardneck garlic, who are forced to grow in mild winter areas but shun the lesser taste of softneck garlic, just chill their hardneck bulbs in the fridge several months before planting to simulate the real winter they won't be getting, but that hardneck garlic really loves. Look to your local state extension website for suggested planting and harvesting times for this technique. Note, as with similar citizen science ventures, such as forcing spring bulbs and the like, the fridge must be fruit-free to prevent accidental early sprouting of the chilled bulbs. But one would suspect that growing a tender variety of garlic in New Jersey would cause it to suffer greatly during really cold winter stretches. Plus, anxious soft-neck grower Gene appears to have sealed the deal by smothering the suffering plants under layers of wet, heavy, whole leaves, whose role in nature is to smother competitive plants trying to grow on the forest floor, not to help them. As a mulch, whole leaves become a killer tarp, not any kind of protection, which is why we beg you every fall to shred all of the leaves you intend to use as a summer and winter mulch. Once shredded, those leaves become one of the best and safest mulching alternatives. Now, let us take a moment to emphasize one of the cardinal rules of gardening. Leave it alone. If you don't know what you're doing, don't do it. Don't pick at it. If the plants in question are rated winter hardy in your area, the only thing they need to be rescued from is your anxiety. If an ice storm is predicted, do not attempt to defensively prune your trees and shrubs. They have survived countless weird weather events. But, like garlic and spring bulbs, they cannot defend themselves from anxious humans with too much time on their hands. Case in point, a phrase that Rod Serling always announced so perfectly, didn't he? We have had very little snow for the last several years in my little town, where the women are strong, the men think they're handsome, and all of the tomatoes are above average. Then came a prediction that a large amount of snow was coming. This time, the professional weather guessers were correct. I had 3 plots of garlic in raised beds that were hidden from my sight for 2 months. When the ice and snow finally melted, it looked like the garlic had been through a war. So I did nothing. And now it looks fabulous. During a warm stretch that followed, they received a light organic feeding as a reward for not being dead. I'll do the same feeding for my spring bulbs after their flowers fade. Not when they're planted, kids. After their flowers fade. Now, basic rules of mulching. The time to apply mulch for winter protection is right around the time the ground freezes hard for the first time that season. And the best mulches are shredded leaves or pine straw. They protect while allowing the ground to breathe. And whatever you do, do not even consider calling in the wood chip dump truck of death. Never cover plants with blankets for any reason. The wet and frozen blankets would soon crush the poor plants. If cover you must, use a breathable fabric like sheer curtains or professional row covers like Reme. But not on your garlic. It don't need it. Well, that was hopefully some helpful advice about only doing what you need to do. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to terminate my tulips if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3, to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming to our garden shores at our new email site, youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, no matter how you contact us, please include your location. I think you're leaving it out deliberately to mess with me. You'll find our new phone number, our new Gmail address, a link to the written version of that all-important question of the week, and new and improved links to our podcast sites. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he found a flight ring that had been lost by a member of the Legion of Superheroes, slipped it on, and crashed into a wall. Our musical director is Wall Crashing Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprod. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Please don't forget to go to WDIY.org. Click on the donate button at the top of the page and pledge your support to our presenting station during their spring fund drive. And thank you. Thank you for supporting You Bet Your Garden, WDIY, and public broadcasting with that generous pledge of support. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be ignoring the sudden freezing cold nights we've been getting once a week, and I will trust my garlic, lettuce, peas, and daffodils to care for themselves as they have for generations, at least until I can see you again next week.